These guys know how to connect with you about Boston sports.
Where do you think people... I blanked. Go.
Felger and Maz on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Despite the fact that it is very difficult, and I know Bill could speak to how difficult it is for these players to win cases like this against the NFL, there has been a precedent of one player fighting exactly, making the same argument that Edelman's making and winning, and that was in 2012 when Richard Sherman was popped for 4 games for PEDs. He fought the league on it, and he ended up winning because he said that the test was ultimately mishandled. That is what Edelman will fight here, and if he can convince the arbitrator, as Sherman did, there is a chance that this thing could be flipped.
All right, that's Jeff Darlington of ESPN, and sort of talking about Edelman's chance here and how he's basing it off of the Richard Sherman successful appeal. Now, excuse me, I think it was 6 years ago. Did he say 2012 in that... report? It was 2012 or 2014, whatever, and how there's similarities. And we tried to piece this together the other day as well in terms of how it was worded in court, that Dan Graziano report on ESPN about how, you know, Edelman was going to appeal this thing. It sounded like it was kind of like Sherman, but was it? So I'm trying to piece this together here. So there's the first part of the Darlington thing. Play the second cut, Jimmy, if you could, please.
If he goes down with the argument of the administration of the test and the process that followed after it was administered, he has a much better chance to win. And now he has picked up some pretty high-powered attorneys in New York who have defended this type of thing.
Spiro.
Which, by the way, is another move that a lot of these guys don't go with. They'll wind up going in there with their sports agent, with all due respect, or good at negotiating contracts, mm-hmm. but not necessarily good at defending the premise of a law.
Okay, so again, he's hired a high-priced criminal attorney, not a sports agent, which makes it different. And again, he talks about the mishandling, and he invokes Richard Sherman. And so that's Darlington. What Graziano reported the other day on ESPN is that one of his lines of appeal involves the mishandling. This is Edelman. Involves a mishandling of the documentation and delivery of Edelman's test results. During the course of the investigation, it was learned that the NFL made mistakes in the manner in which the test results were handled. Edelman has argued that the mishandling of the evidence is one of the reasons he should be exonerated. And we were joking yesterday. What does that mean? Someone smeared mustard on it? Like, what does that mean that he mishandled the documentation and delivery of the results? It doesn't sound like he's challenging the results themselves or how the results were handled. It's the documentation and the delivery of the results. So, like, what does that mean?
I don't know. You got me. Maybe this has some connection to the whole... You know, the whole story about the NFL not being able to identify the substance initially. Like, and I'm just guessing here, I'm grasping at straws. But because to me, that speaks to the handling of the result versus the actual specimen, right? The actual sample.
Right.
Like, there's clearly a difference there.
Well, this is my second developing opinion of the day. Because I'm basing it, because Darlington says this is based off of Sherman's appeal. So Graziano didn't say that yesterday in that ESPN report. This is Darlington saying there's precedent, and it's Richard Sherman. So I went back and I read the details of the Richard Sherman appeal and how he won it. And I'm reading again from the ESPN/AP report. Sherman's appeal was based on errors in the chain of custody of his urine sample and that there were mistakes made by the tester. In his decision, the arbiter, his last name was Wallace, he writes that the collection process of Sherman's urine sample on September 17th, the day after Seattle beat Dallas in Week 2, was not ordinary. According to the decision, Sherman's sample cup began leaking, to which the tester grabbed another cup and transferred the sample. Documentation of the leaking cup was not originally submitted on the report following the test. And only when asked by a supervisor in October did the tester acknowledge the sample being transferred from the original cup. The tester later gave testimony that he'd never experienced a leaking cup before, yet didn't feel the situation rose to the level of needing to be included on his report. The arbiter, Wallace, wrote that the omission of the leaking cup from the report was a, quote, big deal, and that ensuring a sample is collected properly is the cornerstone of the program, and when an event occurs that does not happen routinely or that the collector has never experienced while collecting the sample, it is incumbent upon the collector to note what happened. Accordingly, Mr. Sherman's appeal is granted and the discipline is reversed. Do you know what they're saying there?
Yeah.
It's not that the cup broke.
It's that he didn't document it.
It's that he didn't write it down.
Right.
So what I'm led to believe here is that if one urine cup breaks, you're allowed to take the urine and pour it into another one. But when you file your report, you have to note it and document it and write it step by step. And so Sherman won his appeal not because the cup broke, but because the tester didn't log it, didn't document it. Now go back to Edelman's thing. One of his lines of defense involves the mishandling of the documentation and delivery of the test results.
So that something happened during the testing that the tester did not include on the report.
That did not log on the report. And that's the Sherman precedent. And not that a broken cup nullifies the test. It only nullifies it if the tester doesn't log it and document it and file it as part of his report. So did something happen with Edelman? A broken cup, a dropped cup, a blah, blah, blah. Who
forgot
knows?
Forgot to dot an I. Just
whatever.
A loophole.
Something that, or something that happened in the test that when the tester went down to write down the report, just omitted because he didn't think it was a big deal or wasn't germane, but it was just a detail that was omitted. And Edelman can go to him now and say, according to the Richard Sherman decision, you've got to log everything that happened that was out of the ordinary, everything that happened in the process, and you didn't log it here, so that's my out. And, you know, to me, that, so we were trying to figure out yesterday, right? Like, because it's so, the mishandling of the documentation and delivery of the results. So, I mean, this is just a guess on my part. But when Darlington says that there's precedent, the Richard Sherman thing, that's what I wonder. Did something happen during the test that the tester did not log, did not document?
Well, look, it's entirely possible. I mean, based on the Sherman case, sure. So I just wonder, like, was it purely the documentation of it or... When he said he used another cup, I mean, I'm assuming these guys show up with collection cups, right? Like, is the reason why the test failed because the person being tested, like Sherman, could then just say, well, how do I know the second cup wasn't contaminated?
So
you follow me?
Yeah, Sherman said when he got word on November 12th of the failed test, he knew it had little to do. I'm sorry. He knew that it had to do with the sample collected in September. Quote, it was a weird day, a weird testing procedure, Sherman said. A lot of things went wrong on that day. And that's why the result came out the way it did, because he made mistakes and he did things wrong. So I think it's total crap. All he did is pour the pee from one cup into the next and seal it and take it and test it. But he didn't say that he did that. But that gives Sherman the opening to say that, well, that's why it came out wrong, because somewhere in the transfer from one cup to the other, a anabolic steroid floating through the air, through the ether, somehow invaded the sample from one cup to the other before he sealed it, and a random floating molecule of anabolic steroids got in this test, and therefore that's why it was, and I'm clean. And he's able to claim that he's clean, all because the guy didn't write down that he transferred the pee from one cup to the other.
Okay, but look, and maybe it is as simple as he didn't document it properly, but when he hands Sherman the cup to start the process, is the cup sealed? In other words, is Sherman the only one that can unseal the cup? And then when the cup was leaking, and he poured it into another cup, then he had to unseal it, right? In other words, I'm saying if someone else was involved in the process, and then Sherman can absolutely argue that the cup was contaminated. You following me on this?
Yes, I do, but I don't think that was the crux of it. I think the pure crux of it was that it wasn't documented.
Okay, I would like to know more. I'm just saying that because, to me, just the fact that he didn't write it down, like they all agree that he didn't write it down, and maybe that is grounds. I'm not telling you it's not.
According to the story, that was it. I mean, they don't mention anything else. They mentioned that it wasn't documented. Again.
Sherman, though, said there were a lot of things that went wrong that day.
Well, so now that he won the appeal, he's allowed to claim whatever he wants. The league doesn't release any details, you know, but the player can go out and say whatever he wants. So now Richard Sherman can say, yeah, he screwed a lot of things up. Man, I knew that was going to come back a false positive because he did all this other stuff, but I won and I'm clean. What the AP reported on the written statement, the written decision, was basically Wallace wrote that the omission of the leaking cup from the report was a big deal. Not that the leaking cup was a big deal, the omission of it on the report. And so I don't know. I mean, that's just an example of the technicality
sure.
that Edelman's going for. I like your point yesterday and that you continue to say. Nowhere is he saying I didn't take it. He's just saying, no. The way you documented it, maybe you did spill your lasagna on it and we can't read the writing, or, you know, or something happened with the cup and you didn't write it down in the report, or what, you didn't know what it was, so it doesn't come. Neener, neener, you don't have the name for it. Like, it's whatever it is, it's a technicality. It's not, I didn't take it. With nowhere have I heard him say that.
No, me neither. Yeah. The only thing I've seen him say is, I don't know what went wrong, or something like that. Right,
right? Which is fine. Like, we know these guys, I'll take it, so fine. But this is how he's going to get off, on something like this.
Yeah, look, oftentimes that's how they all do, right? Wasn't that part of Ryan Braun's initial argument, too, is that it was a chain of custody thing?
So I don't know exactly, so I got to dig in and read that, but I did want to read the Sherman thing, because Darlington said it's based on Sherman's appeal.
So, look, I mean, I rule out nothing, and I don't blame him for necessarily appealing it, because if you don't have to serve the 4 games, don't serve the 4 games. But if he takes it to court, if he loses the appeal and takes it to court, that's stupid. Do your time and shut up. See you in week 5.
In Braun's case, just real quick, it had been stored and handled incorrectly prior to testing, giving his claims additional credibility. And he, you know, got off. That 50-game suspension was nullified, but as we ended up finding out, he was on it. You know, he gets off on the technicality, but he even admitted later, yeah, I was taking stuff.
No, but didn't he then fail it? Didn't he end up failing and missing 50 games? I thought he did.
I don't remember. It's a good question. I don't remember. I remember him in spring training doing the press conference where, I think it was spring training, where or whenever it was, attacking a guy.
Oh, brutal.
Oh, because my recollection was that it was in Arizona. That's where the press conference was. And he attacked the tester. And I remember that. And then we found out that he got popped. And I remember thinking, you loser.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Oh, I like this.
This is Felger and Mass.
Part of me wants to do it just to feel what that feels like.
98.5, the Sports Hub.
The Sports Hub. The Sports Hub. The Sports Hub.
All right, to the phones, as promised, we got Tavares on the board and the Edelman stuff. Is there an opening there? Does the Sherman precedent give Edelman an opening? Not that he, you know, that he was clean or that he wasn't taking anything, but is there, again, if it's not documented to a T as proven in the Sherman thing, does he have an opening? So that's what we're discussing here. Steve in the car, what do you got for us?
Hi, this is a little bit off the wall, but I know exactly what I think Edelman might be saying. And you've got this NFL who supposedly has all the T's and I's taken care of, but obviously we've seen they haven't. I had to go for a job, and I was told that I had to take a drug test. So at the end of my regular job, I go and I take my urine test. And she's putting the tape on it, and she breaks the tape. She now throws everything away,
Steve,
and says, Steve, you've got to do it all over again.
Steve, I'm sorry. We're not going to do story time. You know, we've all taken drug tests. We know people have taken drug tests. I don't want to hear... all due respect, love you, mean it, thanks for the call. I don't want to hear about your drug test story. But just picking up on what you're talking about, if they broke the seal, didn't write it down in the report, does Edelman have the right to then go say, well, you didn't write it down in the report? The Sherman case tells us that everything that happens during the testing procedure has to be documented. Yours was not documented. Therefore, I'm off. And is that the kind of technicality that we're looking at here with Julian Edelman?
I mean, look, the littlest technicality could blow the whole thing up. I mean, my question would be, are those cups sealed? When they are handed to the guy who's being tested, are they sealed?
I think so.
And so if that's the case then, and the guy says he poured it into a different cup, then he unsealed the cup. And to me, that's a violation. Can't do it. Done. If that's what happened, then Edelman's going to get off.
But I'm just going to tell you again that that's not why it feels like Sherman was exonerated. What the arbiter wrote is that it wasn't documented. Not that the transferring of the sample or the seals or whatever you're talking about was not mentioned.
I understand that.
All that was mentioned was it wasn't documented.
I understand that. And I'm telling you that feels like a small thing. Nonetheless, it might be enough to destroy it. I would also like to know more.
I'm just telling you that I think what he did was right, except he didn't write it down. Because nowhere does the arbiter say you're not allowed to transfer blah, 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 blah. He only says you didn't document it. That's all. That's what we're talking about. So I was trying to decipher that documentation thing yesterday in the Graziano report, and that could be it. Now maybe they screw up the way they acquired the sample on top of it. But when they say the documentation of the results, that's just my guess of what they're talking. Something like that. Stephen in Plymouth, what do you got?
Hey boys, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, so I do quality assurance for a lot of these labs that do the drug testing for everything from athletes to prisoners to parolees to all this stuff. The problem is with the NFL is you're dealing with a collective bargaining agreement. Collective bargaining agreement states how the drug testing is going to happen. Now, from there, the lab has policies and procedures that happen. When one of those policies or procedures is not fulfilled or there's an error, it's null and void. It's all about the law.
That's it.
You got contract clauses. You got everything that goes into the NFL with the collective bargaining agreement and the players and this and that. So it null and voids it. Does it say that he didn't do it? No. It just says, hey, this sample cannot be used by the law.
Exactly right. Because, again, nowhere in his defense am I hearing, I didn't do it. I didn't take anything. There's no steroids in there. It's, you didn't know the name, Neener Neener, and did you document it properly? That's what we're hearing, right? And, again, like, who really cares? I think we all assume he's doing it anyway, that they're all doing it. Like, you know, we just...
I mean, it's not going to change my opinion of whether he did it.
Of course not. Of course not.
You know, but again, if he gets off the four games, good for him, good for the Patriots. At the end of the day, I don't think it's a huge blow to them because I think they should be enough. They should have enough to win without him in the first four games. But if they can avoid losing him for four, they should. I don't know. I get agitated sometimes by the technicalities. I get agitated because my feeling generally is the guy did it. He's guilty, you know, but there's got to be a process. You have to follow it. And if the test is screwed up, and in the case of Sherman, he clearly did, right? He clearly did.
Do you think Sherman's not on steroids?
No, I think he is.
Oh, God, yeah. Fifth round pick, former receiver out of nowhere. He's Deion Sanders. Yeah, no, that's just whatever. Pure hard work.
Yeah, and I'd be willing to bet that coming off of an Achilles injury that he's taking him more than ever.
God. So, like, do you think anyone who's appealed a suspension is innocent?
No.
Not a single person. Me neither.
Nope.
Not one. I don't care what they say it is or could be or not one he is.
But he could he could get off, though. He could. And again, like, I just wish these things were fully transparent. Like, I wish they gave you every detail. They don't. But could he get off? Sure.
Well, so two things. This is actually in the player's favor, that the player can say whatever he wants. But HIPAA laws and, you know, privacy laws and all those things preclude the league from doing it. So this is why you'll hear these players say, yeah, it was Adderall. I made a mistake. When it wasn't. But the league's not going to correct them. They can't come out and release the official results. So the players can really say whatever they want. And that's a break for the players. They can say whatever they want. They can lie. The league won't be there to correct them.
I'll tell you, though, when the baseball guys get popped, more often than not, you find out what it was for.
No. Well, baseball's different. I'm talking football. Baseball's a whole nother world.
Right, but why can't football leak it?
I just don't feel like they do. I mean,
No, they don't. But why can't, like, the same HIPAA laws apply to baseball, right? Like, and yet it'll come out that Palmeiro was popped for Stanozolol.
Maybe it's collectively bargained, or maybe that was so long ago that there wasn't parameters yet.
Could be.
I mean, I don't know. You tell me. I mean, who was the last guy to get Melky Cabrera? No, who was it this year? Didn't a couple guys get it this year? Didn't Bartolo Colon get it this year?
Robinson Cano?
That's what I'm thinking of. Robinson Cano.
Robinson Cano.
Did they release the substance?
Good question.
I'll check. I mean, look, the same laws apply, obviously, but if it's collectively bargained that we release the results. And
who's
the results.
Red Sox player that got busted, the minor leaguer?
Oh, Chavis.
So, right, do they release the substance? I'm curious about that. So the thing is, the players actually have the advantage in the court of public opinion because they can say whatever they want, and the league says nothing. Also, just know, this isn't the league. This is all, again, collectively bargained. An outside agency does the collecting. The arbiter is determined by both sides. It's mutually chosen. The arbiter, the Wallace for Sherman, and I forget the guy's name for Edelman, was chosen by both the Players Association and the owners. So there's no... This isn't like Deflategate or anything else in front of Roger Goodell, where he's judge, jury, and executioner. No, this is all sort of farmed out, if you will. So there's no real bias there. You want to play that, they're out to get us sort of thing. It doesn't really apply in the drug stuff. It doesn't. Eddie in the car, what do you got on the Bruins and John Tavares? Eddie!
Yo.
You're on the air, Ed.
Now, what if the Bruins made a trade for Tavares' trading rights and traded Krejci along with that?
Huh?
You got to say that again.
I don't even want to.
I'll translate for him. So in the NHL in the past few years, a team will trade a late round draft pick for the rights to sign a player.
Oh, yeah.
That would have happened at the draft over this weekend. That didn't happen. But in the past, you would do that so that you could offer player X his eighth year.
Okay, that
gotcha.
And have, you know, exclusive
control for a few days.
Yeah, right, or however long it is. Sometimes you see it like in the offseason. Jimmy's right. You know, just six-round pick for the rights to so-and-so, and then they can negotiate exclusively with them without the tampering window or any free agency, and then you can offer them the eighth year, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Is it too late to do that?
I think it is. I think there's a trade lockout right now.
I know we're jumping all over the map, but I did look up Cano, and it did come out. And now that I read it, I remember it.
Did it come out, or did the league?
No. The league didn't announce it, but it came out. After testing positive for furosemide, a diuretic sometimes used to hide the presence of other banned substances. So look, this is, and we talked about this at the time, too, that if there's a whole list that doesn't just include the steroids or the HGH or whatever else. There are also masking agents that are on that list that if you are guilty of taking, they assume that you're taking a performance enhancer on top of it. So he tested positive, Robinson Cano did, for a masking agent. And I just feel like oftentimes we find out.
No. Because in baseball, steroids are bad. In football, we don't give a crap.
So maybe that's what it is.
They're actually encouraged. It is a hellacious double standard for the baseball world. It's so true. I frankly don't care these bases. I don't care. Personally, I don't care anymore that the baseball players are on them than football players. Smoke them if you got them. Go nuts. I could care less. But, I mean, again, not to dump on the BBWAA, but I think that's where it starts because I think that they put up such a front about the thing for so long.
Yeah. No, dump away. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I'm just saying that.
I mean, Shaughnessy. And
even if it's collectively bargained, someone could leak it. You can leak it. And so, now look, I give the NFL credit for not. I mean, they're playing that one on the up and up. They play that one straight. Every time a baseball guy gets nailed, you find out what it is 2 weeks later or within a week. Yeah. Like they do, they throw these guys under the bus. And so maybe it is. Maybe it's because they reinforce that stigma thing. Like, it totally could be it. But I just, you know, I would love to know what Edelman tested positive for. Let's, you know, I don't, like...
Don't you think in this case it almost, it's gotten so high profile?
Oh, we'll never find out.
You don't think?
Nope. I think that makes it less likely we'll find out.
I think I just...
Although maybe that it's a Patriot, they'd be more inclined to release it. Like, who knows? You know, maybe they say, you know what, screw the Patriots, they're a pain in the ass. And maybe someone in the league off, maybe someone in the league office leaks it.
These guys were going to leak it.
Exactly.
These guys suck.
Sherman we like. The Patriots are a-holes. We're going to leak what the substance was.
All right, we have a Red Sox minute coming up. Maz has some thoughts on Chris Sale. And his arc this year, if you will. That's coming up next, the Red Sox Minute, right after Murray's update.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5, The Sports Hub.
Oh, I like this.
This is Felger and Mass.
Part of me wants to do it just to feel what that feels like.
98.5, The Sports Hub.
The Sports Hub.
The Sports Hub.
The Sports Hub.
Maz, Red Sox Minute, what do we got?
Okay, so in the last day or so, and this goes back to the game on Sunday that Chris Sale pitched against the Mariners, which was an exceptional performance, might have been some of the best stuff he's had as a member of the Red Sox. Really, I thought he was dynamite. I mean, he had it all going. 13 strikeouts, 7 innings, low pitch count, he dominated. And the prevailing theme yesterday was, boy, look at where Sale is now compared to a year ago. And this was in The Globe, it was on ESPN.com, and I'm just reading from Peter Abraham in The Globe, because this was sort of the common theme yesterday, okay? And this is Abraham. He writes, the most telling marker, the one that could have the greatest impact on Sale and the Red Sox months from now, is that Sale has thrown 11 and two-thirds fewer innings and 138 fewer pitches than he did through 17 starts a year ago. Okay, now this is almost exactly the halfway point of the season. So the point is 17 starts to 17 starts, halfway to halfway. Sale is 11 and two-thirds innings less and 138 pitches less. And you say, well, that sounds small. It's not. It's not.
That's a full start and
a
change,
half.
Yeah.
Right. Really, you could even argue that it's two starts if you go by the innings, six per. So if you add these up and you do the same thing in the second half of the season, maybe you're saving the guy 23 and a third innings, call it 24. That's four starts. And you're saving them 300 pitches.
A lot.
It's a lot. Okay, those are bullets. You use every one of those bullets in October. So I agree with the premise. Like, I look at it and say, that sounds good.
Except, and also, you've been saying it since the day they signed the guy. I mean, these all, everyone else said, Johnny come lately. You told us all early last spring, you know, look out. This sale has a history of fading, and they should be managing them. So finally they're doing it, and now everyone's like, oh, yeah, see? You know,
well, right.
Like, you've been saying this from day one.
So to me, the fact that the Red Sox weren't on it a year ago, to me, was a mistake. They should have been on it a year ago. They weren't. They made a mistake. They paid the price. He faded. And then in October, in his first playoff start, he got shellacked. And so now they're trying to fix that. And all this sounds good, except that I look at the numbers and I say, all right, so you wipe out, you know, you minimize, or you save him three or four starts. Call it four. And you save him 300 pitches. But he started to go bad in really the middle of August last year, when you look at it. So that's closer to eight starts, nine in the playoffs. You follow me?
Not that part.
Okay. So in other words, the final month and a half of the season last year is when he started to lose it.
So what you're saying is
he wasn't the final pitcher for the final eight starts of the year.
We haven't reached the moment of truth yet.
Correct, and they might not be saving enough.
We don't know if this new approach has saved him.
Well, and that part is for sure. Like, I look at it and say, okay, so we threw 100 miles an hour on a Sunday in June. All of a sudden, we're going to say that the thing is working, when the reality is, we don't know that it's working. It looks like it's working now, but he had good games in June last year. Like, you got to compare June to June. So when you do it from that standpoint, you say, no, we can't definitively say that this is working. We can say that the innings are down and the pitch totals are down, but that's no guarantee that he's going to be better in September and October, and it might take more for him to be better in September and October, because what they're saving him now might get him, you know, at the it might take him into the middle of September instead of the middle of August.
I see.
Right? Like, it feels like he needs more than that. And if I'm the Red Sox, here's what I do. Sales get three starts left before the All-Star break. The last one is the Wednesday before, which is perfect. Because if he's going to make his regular turn, you don't want him pitching any of the final four games. So he gets the final four games off. He gets the whole break off then.
And then pitch him fifth coming back.
Bingo. And so that's the part we don't know yet. If they stick on their current rotation, again, he will go the Wednesday before the All-Star break, which gives him the biggest possible rest going into the break.
He goes first on the way into the All-Star break and last on the way out.
Exactly. Then they play on the Friday coming out. They shouldn't start until Tuesday. If they do that, he'll get 2 weeks. 2 week break in the middle of the season.
Is he in danger of being an All-Star?
Maybe. And you know what? I tell him,
turn it down.
No, play some Xbox.
Good God.
time for Fortnite, pal.
Let's fire it up.
Yeah, sir. Get off that building. Like, that's the way I go. Don't let this guy pitch in the All-Star game. Come up with something phantom on the final weekend of the season. He pitches Wednesday. Sale woke up on Friday or Saturday. Oh, geez, his back spasms. You know what? He's not going to be able to pitch in the All-Star game. Beg out of that thing. Get out.
Don't make an excuse about an injury. We'll just fire up the Xbox. All right, we're online.
He's so good with that sniper rifle. Chris, get on there. Oh, get on top of that. Pew, pew. Oh, that's so good. This is how you get out of it, bro.
Perfect.
Exactly. It's exactly what they should do. And then
grab a controller, grab a headset.
That's
it. So you picked it up right away. You don't play till the Friday coming out of the break. You pitch them the fifth game. Don't pitch them that first weekend. I don't even care who they're playing that weekend. I looked, I don't even remember. So it couldn't have been anyone of consequence. Do not pitch them on that first weekend coming out of the break. Do not do it. Hold them out until Tuesday. They're at Detroit, then they go to Baltimore. So either way, you should be able to beat those teams. You don't need Chris Sale to pitch twice against those crap bum organizations. Save him to give him 2 weeks, two solid weeks. And if it sets him back a little, so be it. Fine. So he's not as sharp on July 24th at Baltimore. Who gives a flying fish on that one? Who gives a rat's ass? Get him ready for August and September. Just because they're on pace, don't buy into it. Because I'm not convinced this guy's going to hold up on the current pace, and they're doing a pretty good job at it. He needs more. Give him more.
Okay, so there is your Red Sox minute. Want to weigh in on that by all means. Want to weigh in on Tavares? Bruins are meeting with the free agent today in Los Angeles. My big takeaway today is quit obsessing over how they're going to make the room. They've already made the room. They wouldn't be meeting with Tavares. Tavares wouldn't be taking the meeting if the Bruins couldn't fit him on their payroll. Don't you see? That would make no sense for them to go out there, pitch John Tavares, win the John Tavares sweepstakes, and then say, oh, actually, we don't have the room. They already have the room. So don't handicap it like that anymore. Handicap it like this. Does Tavares want to come here? Because you have the room. So we're talking about that, the Edelman appeal, all of this, with your calls right after this in our long commercial free segment.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
At the end of your ride home, you'll be all caught up.
You get suspended again, you're going to miss playoff time, or you're going to miss time in the playoffs.
Or questioning your judgment.
Sorry I brought it up.
Felger and Mass, 98.5 The Sports Hub.
1-2, looking down the barrel of his 13th strikeout today.
You know, if he twists his wrist, he's out. If he throws him a high fastball, he's out. I don't know. I mean, take your choice.
This crowd very appreciative of his mastery. And he struck him out at 100 miles an hour. He struck out three more in the inning. He has 13. Sailing indeed. Red Sox on top, 5-0. Chris Sale, just brilliant.
And how do they keep that going into September and October? That's the question this year with Chris Sale. That's on the table with everything else. Right back to the phones as promised. Tim in Nashua following up on the John Tavares stuff. Go ahead, Tim.
Mike, with a player like that, you're dealing away Krug. Is it worth keeping Krejci and moving him to the wing, or you think that's too crazy and he's all done?
I think at 32 years old, a lifetime centerman, to now you're playing wing for $7.25 million, no thank you.
And no. The other thing is he can't shoot the puck.
Yeah, right. I think he's got a pop gun. He's got a pop gun release there. He's just, you know, how often do you see Krejci wind up from that Stamkos spot? And he scored the last, like the game five against Tampa. You know, after I spent a week saying he never scores, of course. As soon as I do that, he scores on one of those one-timers from the left circle. But for the most part, he's not a sniper. He's a setup man.
I mean, I think he's your classic, pure playmaking center. You know, like he's the equivalent of a true point guard in basketball.
So look, if you're telling me on the list of guys that I would trade before Krejci, Backes is easily number one. Like there's just, obviously. Would I rather have Krejci or Krug? I think I'd rather have Krug. I think Krejci might be second on the list.
See, I think at this stage, Krug's a better player.
Yeah, and younger and just more valuable. I was going to say more valuable position. I mean, I don't know. I just think.
And less money.
Yeah, for sure. So I think, no, Krejci would be two on my hit list.
Which is why I think that Krug is more tradable. Like, I think ultimately, they can get something for Krug. Someone will take Krug.
The thing is, with Krejci is just now the fit on your roster, and I'm not even talking about your payroll. I'm talking about Krejci is now a third-line center or a fourth-line center? That's just, no, that's not what he is. And that's not usually how those minutes go. I mean, maybe you'd have a strong offensive third line, but I don't know. Just generally, you know, ask him to slot in behind two other centers. I just don't know if that's what he is. Ray and Rivera. Go ahead, Ray, on Julian Edelman.
Yeah, three quick points. Michael, I always ask the same question when people say legalize steroids. What do I tell that kid in high school when he says, Dad, I got a juice to make it? Second point, relative to the chain of custody and steroids, it's all about the chain of custody. It's exactly how the Russians cheated. Remember the glory hole for the urine sample that they had? And then third point, I've never seen a professional football player come back from either a suspension or getting off from beating a suspension. They're never the same player. I hope Edelman wins because I'd like to see him get his money. The contract's not guaranteed, and I'm rooting for him.
Okay, so on those three things, I never said legalize steroids. I just said I don't care if you do them. I know that's a fine line. I think the place that the NFL's gotten to, and I don't know if baseball's gotten there yet, is a pretty reasonable compromise, which is we say we're against them, we're going to test for them, but we allow you certain levels. So you're allowed to go to a certain point. But if you go over those limits, you go 85 and a 55, we're going to pop you. And we got to keep you honest at some point because we're not going to turn this into just a science experiment. We're not going to become the WWE. Sorry, Jimmy. But you've all got to, you know, you got to be strong and you've got to stay healthy and you've got to recover. So we're not really going to test for HGH, and we're going to allow you elevated testosterone levels, and we'll give you a nice little window there around the new year to do what you got to do, and just keep it, you know, keep it in check. And I think that's sort of where the NFL is, and I think that's a fair compromise. I think moralistically, I think you're right. That would be a very, that would be a rough stance. That would, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with a league saying, you know, we allow steroids. Like, aren't there some bodybuilding competitions that there's no testing and they're known for being no testing? And you just look at the people, you know, so there's like quote unquote clean circuits and, you know, non-testing circuits.
I mean, I have no idea.
I think that's the way it works. I believe that's the way it works. But if you're just saying, you know, do whatever you want, then you become WWE or you become these silly bodybuilding things, which I don't think they need to be.
No, look, it feels to me like they've reached a pretty good place, all things considered. I always equate it to, we'll let you go 65, maybe even 70 in a 55. But if you start going 80 miles an hour and you're changing lanes and swerving all over the road, we're going to pull your ass over. Like, to me, it's really that simple.
We've got Mike in Woburn. How do you feel about John Tavares to the Bruins, Mike?
I love it. But first, I know you're about to talk hockey. Do you want to check Brady's Instagram or Giselle's Instagram? Make sure there's nothing breaking right now.
Oh, no, we're on it, Mike. We're on it.
Okay. All right. Listen, this, if the Bruins get Tavares, this puts them in the Pittsburgh model, which is two dominant centers. You've got your dominant Letang-type defenseman, and now you just basically bring up the kids and feed them into the system and let them succeed. Because that's what Pittsburgh's done. They've got their two dominant centers. They've got their two foundational wingers with Kessel and Hornquist. And what they've done the past 2 years that they've won cups, Sheary, Rust, all these kids that they've brought up have just produced because you're sticking talented kids that you've properly developed next to all-star caliber players, and it's the way that a team needs to be built now in a hard cap NHL. You can't, like, and it's sort of what they tried to do this year was they strayed away from it when they went out to make that deal for who's the guy from Ottawa, Brassard, and sort of go with a massive third line guy when a reclamation project like Riley Nash probably would have worked the way Bonino worked for them before. The Bruins are perfectly situated for this because of all the talent they have in their development system right
now.
So,
Mike, it makes perfect sense for them. As I've been saying all day, they have the room if they want it. I think they've already figured it out. The question is, does Tavares want you? Why would Tavares want to come here?
Why? Because this team, they're poised to contend. And Mike, I know you said that Backes is the first contract you want to get rid of. I disagree. That's a situation that may resolve itself. Now, I don't want to be, you know, callous when talking about another guy's health, but if the concussion thing goes the way it looks like it's going, he may end up being one of those guys where you long-term IR until they ultimately retire. Why would you give one of the bullets that you want to put next to Tavares or Bergeron going forward, give up that to move Backes when all you need to do really is find a buyer for Krejci who doesn't have that injury history, who could look, appealing to a team that needs that second center, and you resolve the problem that way.
Okay, I'm with you. All I'm saying is the Bruins know how to have whatever money they need, they know how they're going to get it. That's all. And this fumbling around about how do they create the room? How do they move this guy? How do they move that guy? How does Tampa fit? All these teams would not have a seat at the table if they didn't have a way out of the money.
No, they have a plan already.
They wouldn't waste their time getting on a plane to Los Angeles. And Tavares and his agents, who have been all over this, would not give you a seat at the table if they looked at your payroll and said, you can't afford him. You can't move that money. You're not going to be able to. So we're not even going to waste our time. Anyone who's at that table in Los Angeles this week has the room. And if they don't have the room on the face of it right now, they have deals in place and things they know they can do that'll give them the room like that as soon as pen goes to paper. Maybe it's as simple as Backes retiring and going on long-term IR or something like that. But the Bruins would not be out there and they would not have a seat at the table unless they knew what it was. And it has to. I mean, it has to, just by definition, involve Backes, Krejci, Krug.
It's got to be one of those guys.
There's no one else. Rask, you know, and that's, I'm not even sure about that. I think they like Rask to a point. I mean, I don't know. Rask is sort of a half. I know they love Krug, but they just signed Greslick, who does roughly the same thing, not quite as well, but for a fourth of the cost. So it's like, it's Backes, it's Krejci, it's good. There's no one, I mean, they're not going to sign Char to that one-year deal and then deal, you know, Char's not going anywhere. There's no, that's it. Those are the three and a half guys, if you will. Krejci, Backes, Krug, maybe Rask, although I doubt it.
Yeah, to me, it's got to be one of those three. It's got to be, you know, like you said, Krejci, Backes, or Krug. And to Mike's point, Mike the caller's point, you know, if you really think about it, Tavares is a perfect fit for them. I mean, he's perfect, right? Bergeron's what, 32 now? This guy's 27, so when Bergeron ages and he starts to peter out, now Tavares moves into that role, and now hopefully you have another guy to step in. Whether you draft him, who knows, wherever you get him, you get him. But the idea is that it really does set you up for the long haul. He's perfect for them.
Felger and Mass, the Sports Hub.